Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
As an avid listener to the Pigskin Dispatch, you know how we like to preserve all of football history. So today we're going to go a little bit more modern flavor and talk about the Washington football team, the Washington Redskins squad that started in the 1960s through the early 70s. And we have Jim Johnson, a historian from the area, coming on in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome back to the Pigpen. We have another great episode where we're going to talk some great NFL history. And we're going to talk a little bit about the East Coast teams, and in particular, the Washington Redskins. Now, the last couple of years, they have been the Washington football team. But prior to 2020, they were the Washington Redskins ever since 1937. We have our guest today is Jim Johnson, who hails from that area. Jim Johnson, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, Darren.
Now, Jim, you have an interesting aspect. You have a nice website if you could give us those the address of your website so people can find it.
It is beltwayfootballhistory.com.
Okay, and the Beltway history, from what I'm gathering, is basically the Baltimore and Washington franchises. You're covering the Colts, the Ravens, and the Redskins, Washington football teams. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So that's some great football there, you know, a lot of championships between those three teams. That's for sure.
Oh, it really is. The history of that area is just fantastic. And, if you go all the way back, the Redskins won the championship in their first year in Washington in 37. They had this rookie quarterback named Sammy Baugh that turned out fairly well. And they had, I think, a couple other ones. And, of course, Joe Gibbs had the three championships. And then you look over Baltimore, the Colts had three championships. The Ravens had two. Just a rich history. But it's interesting because all three franchises also have had their downs. And, obviously the Washington franchise has been stuck in that cycle for some time. So I think it's what really makes it interesting is you look at the ups and downs and what built the team up and then what took them down. And usually they get old, but then, how quickly do they rebuild? So some very interesting stories to tell just between those three franchises and about 30 miles apart from each other.
Okay. We're going to put that address of your website in the show notes of this podcast. So listeners, you can click a link there and go over and check out Jim's work that he has there on these three great teams. Now, we're going to sort of focus in, though, on the Washington franchise. And sort of 1964, you pointed out before we started recording here, was sort of a pivotal year for the Redskins. And perhaps you could share with us why that was.
Well, yeah, they really had floundered miserably since they won the last championship. They played for the NFL championship in 1945 against the Cleveland Rams, which that tells you how long ago it had been, right?
Right.
And they had, through the 50s, had pretty much been horrible, and the 60s didn't start out any better, although they did get the new stadium in 1961, the state-of-the-art DC stadium, which was one of the first circular cookie-cutter multi-purpose stadiums. But back then, it was an enormous upgrade from Griffith Stadium, where the old Senators had played. That park was about 50-some years old. So they continued to flounder. But in 1964, they made two crucial trades. They picked up Sam Huff, the great New York Giants Hall of Fame linebacker, and he picked up Sonny Jurgensen from the Philadelphia Eagles straight up for Norm Snead. Norm Snead had been the Redskins' number one draft pick. I think it was in 61, maybe in 62, I forget exactly. And he struggled, but, you know, look what was around him, you know. So both teams were just trying for to take quarterbacks that had struggled in the other team and hope that the new scenery would help them. Jurgensen wound up in the Hall of Fame. Snead didn't, so you see who won that trade. Because Jurgensen had had taken over in Philadelphia in 1961 from Norm Van Brocklin after they won the championship with him in 1960. And he had a good year in 61, and they finished second. But then he had a shoulder injury that lingered. The team fell apart. They kind of got old all at once. That happens so often. And 62, 63, and 64, they were struggling. And you know how well Philadelphia fans do with teams struggling, right?
Right. So
Sonny couldn't get out of there quick enough. He was really happy for the change of scenery, which is interesting because, by contrast, Sam Huff is still bitter about getting traded from the Giants. And he never left the Washington area. He settled in. He's had business interests. He was a Redskin radio broadcaster for over 30 years. But he still says he will never forgive Ali Sherman, the Giants coach, who traded him, just because he was just so settled in and still loves. I don't know if he does it anymore, but for many, many years, loved to go back to New York, and he still treated him as, you know, one of the guys, one of the parts of the Giant franchise. So it was interesting. They came in with such different perspectives, yet they both became people that the team was able to build around. And also in 64, the Redskins drafted Charlie Taylor. Now, they drafted him as a running back. He was a running back in college at Arizona State. Not so much a good pro running back, but they saw that he had the ability to run patterns, and they threw to him some. Sonny loved throwing to running backs. And then in 66, when Otto Graham became the coach, he became a full-time flanker at that time, wide receiver as we know it now, and he wound up in the Hall of Fame. So in 1964, they accumulated three Hall of Fame players that finished their careers there, had long careers, and over time they were able to fill in players around them that they became competitive, even though it still took them several years to make the playoffs.
Okay. Now, that's interesting that Otto Graham, you know, of course, the great Cleveland Browns quarterback, got into coaching, coaching the Redskins. Do you feel that maybe having Otto Graham as his coach helped Jurgensen's career to some extent too?
It's hard to tell. I think it probably did. And what also helped it in some ways was not having a running game. Because in 67, they had the two wide receivers were Charlie Taylor and Bobby Mitchell, who they had gotten from Cleveland in 62. And, of course, Bobby Mitchell's in the Hall of Fame. So you've got those guys to throw to and an extremely underrated tight end, Jerry Smith. And in 67, Sonny threw the ball more frequently than any quarterback had in NFL history, and he threw for more yardage. I think he had like 3,800 yards, which was an astronomic figure in the 60s. And his receivers were numbers 1, 2, and 4 in the league in receptions. So that's when, you know, Sonny had obviously had good years up to that point. But Graham pretty well cut him loose with the air game. Now, part of it was they had no choice. They had a running back that got even 500 yards in a season. And, you know, Sonny loved throwing the ball. He wasn't a man bomber by any stretch. He was a very surgical thrower and had one of the great arms in history. But, you know, like a quarterback like Elway and Bradshaw are known for their bombs, Sonny is known for just throwing the ball on a dime in traffic. And he had guys that could some kind of catch it and then do something with the ball, because Bobby Mitchell was a converted running back. So you had guys that could, even though they weren't, Bobby Mitchell was a pretty good running back. He was much better than Charlie Taylor. But both of those guys, once they got the ball out there and they were in traffic, then they could run with it. And a lot of receivers were not at that level as those two guys were running after the cash, or yak, as they like to call it now, yards after cash.
Right.
They got a lot of them during the career. So, Graham obviously let him go, and he was smart enough not to make them, well, you call it now a mistake, maybe, that Otto Graham, or that Paul Brown made when he was coaching Otto Graham, not letting him call plays. You know, Otto was smart enough not to try to call plays for Sonny Jurgens, and Sonny did a pretty good job on his own.
Okay. Now, the 3,800 yards back in that era, they were only playing 12, 14 game seasons then. So yeah. You think that in comparison today, now we consider, hey, 4,000 yards for a quarterback and a 16 game season, now 17, that's a pretty good year for him. He's only 200 yards away from that with less games. So that's pretty monumental to have 3,800 yards in a season.
Yeah, he had shattered what was the NFL record at that time. Now, at the same time, Joe Namath, I think it was the same season, threw for 4,000 in the AFL. Now, the AFL had a much more wide open game, so I would not equate that to Jurgensen, even though Jurgensen threw less. You know, the NFL was a very, very much a run-oriented league in the 60s and well into the 70s. So I think that was probably one of the greatest passing seasons anybody had, maybe until Marino came along in 84.
Yeah, and while the AFL, at least at first, had the advantage, their ball was a little bit shaped more like our more modern ball, where it had the points a little bit less girth. So it was more apt to the spiral in the passing game, where the NFL at that time when the AFL first came out had the little bit bigger ball, wasn't as passer friendly. So that's even more of a feat for Jurgensen to do, be close to what Namath's numbers were in the same year. So. You got to take your hats off to him for that. That's for sure.
Absolutely. And he got him competitive. You know, you had a belief, and he was the quarterback when they started selling out the games. Now, of course, for many, many years, it was a given that you couldn't buy a ticket at the game. You know, they were all season tickets. But that didn't start until, I think, 65, the sellout streak, 65, 66. But it was during Sonny's early years. They weren't winners yet, but they were winning. And that's when their rivalry started with the Cowboys, because the Cowboys got good and the Redskins were able most days to play with them and sometimes beat them. And they had the early games they had in that rivalry, Sonny against Don Meredith. They had some incredible games, which were, again, kind of unusual. You know, both teams in the 30s. You know, you didn't get a lot of those games back in the day. And just the fact that the Redskins matched up well with them and kind of punched above their weight were the early seeds of the Cowboy-Redskin rivalry. Let me throw in a story you may be aware of, but I ran across it recently that just tickled me. The first volley in the Redskins-Cowboys rivalry was before the Cowboys even had a team. George Preston Marshall was the owner of the Redskins up until he passed away in 68, 69. And he was the one who was the first one who got the band at the games. And his wife wrote the lyrics to Hail to the Redskins. Well, they had a bitter divorce because he liked to play around, apparently. And after the divorce, she still had the rights to the song. So Clint Murchison, who was the original owner of the Cowboys, was lobbying for expansion at that time. This was 58, 59. And George Preston Marshall was a visionary in many areas, but he was dead set against expansion because he just saw the pie getting cut in smaller slices. He was not envisioning the bigger pie. So he and the vote at that time had to be unanimous. So he could not even get one no vote. So what happened was Murchison saw a weakness and he approached a fairly bitter ex-wife and bought the rights to Hail to the Redskins.
No kidding.
And he leveraged Marshall's vote because he said, I own a song and you can't play it. Unless... you maybe change your mind on that expansion.
Wow. So a little bit of blackmail to get Big D in the NFL. Wow.
Brilliant blackmail. Yeah. Legal blackmail.
Right. Right. That was kind of brilliant. We just had a nice discussion on that. We had an author of 10 Gallon Wars, which is the sort of the story of Dallas football. The second version of the Dallas Texans, which turned into Kansas City Chiefs, and the Dallas Cowboys sort of coming up at the same time, one in the NFL, one in the AFL. And that was an interesting book. I had not heard that story, though, about the Redskins and the George Preston Marshall.
You got to file that one away. That is one of the classics.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. That's great. Now, I got a question. Okay. You said like in the mid 60s, the Redskins got their stadium. I believe you called it the DC Stadium.
DC Stadium.
Now, is that what evolved into being RFK, or was that a different stadium?
No, it was the same stadium. They renamed it shortly after Senator Kennedy was assassinated.
Okay.
So for the 1969 season, it became known as Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium, or as everybody called it, RFK.
Okay. So it's the same stadium that I sort of grew up watching Washington play in during those years of the 70s and early 80s.
And it still stands, although nobody plays there now. The last team was a soccer team, and they got their own stadium probably about 3-4 years ago. So it's just a matter of, they're probably just waiting for it to fall down, because that stadium is now over 60 years old.
Wow. That's got to be a prime piece of real estate there too. You'd think somebody would be trying to grab that.
It is federally owned.
And
that's what the leveraged, you may be familiar with the story of how George Preston Marshall was finally forced to integrate. He was the last team, the last major sport team to integrate, not just in the NFL. And he was just steadfast. Hey, you know, we let, well, I'm not going to say exactly what he said, but, you know, they let black players play against us. So what does it matter? I'm not telling anybody they can't play or they can't come to the games. But then when the Kennedy administration was in place in 61, which is when the stadium was getting ready to open, in order to sign the lease with the Department of Interior, which had, and I believe still has domain over that land, he had to sign a non-discrimination clause, which had just been made standard in federal contracts. And he got leveraged, threatened, whatever, that they would void his lease if he was in breach of contract and he would have nowhere to play. So he never admitted that's why he did that. But in 61, the draft was in like December back then. He drafted his first black player and made the trade for Bobby Mitchell, who came over in 62. And because of that clause is what was what finally pushed him over. Without that, who knows?
Now, I guess the perception I always get of George Preston Marshall, I mean, even going back to the 30s when, you know, he started the Boston Braves and, you know, changed that name to the Redskins in Boston and moved the team. And, you know, in some stories like this, I always get he's somewhat of a villainous character. Is that the way he was perceived in the Beltway area?
Well, he was a complicated guy because he, by every count, he was an absolute racist bigot. That doesn't mean that he didn't do good things for the league. You know, he was very much a promoter. He built a network, basically, and this was all connected. They were the southernmost team in the NFL until the Atlanta Falcons came in 1966. So before they had the national TV contracts, he had his own little syndicated network all the way through the South. So North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and all that was Redskin territory.
Okay.
And at one point in the late 50s, he had even, he didn't have the copyright law to do this, but he had even changed the words in Hail to the Redskins. Instead of fight for old DC, he changed it to fight for Dixie.
Really? Wow.
Really was kind of pandering to his Southern fans, his Southern base, as it were. And I read that in his last will and testament, he had bequeathed money for charity, but no charity that practiced integration.
Wow.
His family didn't know that. His family challenged it, and they got that clause thrown out in court. So his money was widespread, because if you can imagine, in D.C., that would have been very challenging.
Right. Yeah. That's
right. So they were able to get that thrown out in court, but that was like his last will was still man. So he was kind of complicated, because he was very gregarious. There were people that really liked him, even though they knew he was a bigot, because he was one of those guys, when you're around him, of course, you're a white guy and you're around him, it was hard not to like him. And he did, you know, a lot. He was very much an innovator in the marketing and entertainment aspect of football. He's way ahead of his time on that. But yeah, at the core, he really had some bitter issues, and they never went away. He went away finally.
Yeah, that's sad.
No,
that's sad. Huh. Well, let's go back into the team, I guess. So the 1960s, you know, Jurgensen, Taylor, and Mitchell, you know, are sort of the core players that are bringing this franchise along. You know, they're winning some games, having some good seasons, 3,800 yards by Jurgensen. How does that take them through the rest of that decade? How did they do?
Well, they were flirting with 500, but they couldn't get over 500. Because, you know, they didn't have a running game, and their defense, even with Sam Huff, but Sam Huff was at the back end of his career, their defense wasn't very good either. So, you know, Sonny was putting on a good show and keeping them competitive, but, you know, they didn't have the help around him. So Otto Graham only lasted 3 years as coach. And then in 68, Sonny missed some time injury. And, of course, you know, the backup, he had a veteran backup, Jim Nanowski, came in, but he wasn't Sonny Jurgensen. Without Sonny Jurgensen, they got their butt kicked. That opened up the job. And in 69, Edward Bennett Williams had taken over as president of the team, as George Preston Marshall had been incapacitated, although Edward Bennett Williams only owned like about 5% of the team. But he was voted in as president. Jack Kent Cook had not arrived on the scene. He was still out on the West Coast with the Lakers. So he had voted his shares, his voting rights to his shares, to Edward Bennett Williams. So Edward Bennett Williams makes the coup of hiring Vince Lombardi. In the city of Washington in 1969, Vince Lombardi was the head football coach, and Ted Williams was the manager of the Washington Senators.
Wow, two legends.
And there I am as a 10-year-old kid seeing those guys on the cover of Sports Illustrated, which was like the number one honor you could get in sports at that time, right?
Right.
And within a few months of each other, like, oh my gosh, because I, you know, I hadn't been watching sports that long, but I had already learned that, you know, teams in Washington lost. That's what they did. And then, you know, the Senators get a winning record. And then the Redskins get a winning record. They were 7-5-2, I think it was, in Lombardi's first year. And you could tell they still needed more players. But Lombardi took basically the same team they had in 68, insert a few guys here or there, but they were, and they got outclassed 3 or 4 times. But every game they had a chance to win, they pretty much won. And you could just see that I don't want to say the sky was the limit, but everybody figured the next year, it was the same thing he did in Green Bay. His first year in Green Bay, they were competitive. The next year, they played in the championship game. And the third year, they won the championship. And, you know the rest of that story. So he was on the same trajectory when, of course, tragically, he died because he hadn't taken care of himself. You know, he is as much a reason as any one person that you get colonoscopies.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. He was only like 58 years old, I believe, when he passed.
Something around that, yeah. He was still a very young man, but he had felt horrible for months. And finally, people around him would nag him and nag him. You can just imagine nagging Vince Lombardi, right? But eventually he felt bad enough that he gave into it, and by then it was way too late. So they did what they could. And of course, medicine was not the same 50 years ago as it is now. And they have the Vince Lombardi wing at Georgetown Medical Center, the cancer wing. They did a lot of development. They did a lot of fundraising in his name. So, you know, even in passing, you know, he did good things, and he was always very community oriented. Of course, unfortunately, that was a memorial. But that set him back a year. They were 6-8 the year after that, and the several games they could have won, they didn't. It was not a huge difference, but it was enough of a difference.
Now, who took over after Coach Lombardi had passed? Who took over the Redskins as the coach?
Bill Austin, who had a unsuccessful tenure with the Steelers, like everybody else did back in those days. And then he had been an assistant with Lombardi in Green Bay, then he got the Steelers job, and Lombardi hired him in Washington. I think he was offensive line. I mean, that's the main thing he coached. I'm not sure what he coached in 69. So, you know, with him passing away in August before the season started, it wasn't like they could do a search. So he basically was the interim for a year.
So it was just a couple weeks before the next season was starting.
I think he had coached a little bit in camp. He had had surgery, and he got out, and he coached a little bit, and he watched one of the exhibition games. But then they did a recheck, and they found more cancer, and he did not last very long after that. So, but yeah, it was, I think, late August before he passed away. And the season started later back then, but still, it was less than a month before kickoff.
Yeah, how could any team recover from that if you lose your leader like that? Wow.
And especially that leader.
Yeah.
You know, and I know in particular, Sonny Jurgensen got a lot of sympathy from folks, that he had a taste of success. Sonny Jurgensen was like svelte. He was in great shape. And, you know, that's not what he was known for in his career. He had a belly he carried around, but you know, Lombardi literally whipped him into shape, and he loved it. He loved being coached by Lombardi. So, yeah, there was like the air just got let out of the balloon. And it's a credit to what he had built that they managed to win six games that year and not completely fall apart, because they were a competitive team. But then, you know, less than 2 years after getting Lombardi, Edward Bennett Williams struck again and got George Allen. And he was able to, you know, the Wheeler dealer, in 1971, they called his first team the Ramskins, because he got, I think, somewhere between 10 to 12 players from the Rams team that he had just gotten fired from. And he never met a draft choice he liked. So he was always trading draft choices. In fact, they caught him trading the same draft choice a couple of times. And I think they got a penalty. But I think the penalty was they lost another draft choice, so it didn't really bother him. Probably got fined. And he largely remade that team in his image. But I think what also remade it in his image was Sonny Jurgensen getting injured in exhibition season in 71. You know, of course he was going to be a starting quarterback. But they had traded for Billy Kilmer, backup quarterback, which is like, hey, that's a great idea. You never know, right? Sonny was getting up there. He was in his mid-30s. And then I think it was the last exhibition game, or either next to last. Remember, they played six exhibition games. I know. Can you believe that?
And the starters actually played all six of those too.
I mean, they really played. It wasn't just a dress rehearsal. And Sonny threw an interception, and he was making the tackle, when he broke his arms, left arm. But he was still out for weeks. And then Billy goes in, and they win their first five games, and the town goes nuts. Even the sixth game they lost, which really turned around their season, because not only did they lose, they lost Charlie Taylor. He broke his ankle. Huh. And by that time, Bobby Mitchell was retired, so their wide receiver core was kind of thin. I think they had Roy Jefferson at that point, but beyond that, they were really kind of thin. So, I'll never forget that. When they came home from that game, thousands greeted them at National Airport. Just an outpouring. The town was berserk with Redskin fever. It's like, my God, 5-0, we got to make the playoffs. And they did, although they had to get the wild card, because the rest of the season they kind of staggered. You know, they had beaten Dallas in Dallas in that five-game stretch. Dallas came into RFK and beat the Redskins 13-0. Just couldn't generate. even though you know, Larry Brown was starting to emerge as a big running back. He had his big year the next year. But the defense and special teams, you know, that's what George Allen coached. He had the first full-time special teams coach, Marv Levy, sure you've heard of him.
Right.
That's where he got his, I don't know if it was his start, but that's where he got some attention, was being a special teams coach. And, you know, they had good return teams and they had great kick blocking teams. You know, they turned multiple games around. And of course, the only touchdown they scored in the Super Bowl against Miami was on a blocked kick. And, you know, thanks to Garrow doing whatever he was doing.
They almost got back in that game too after.
They got the ball back.
Right.
They got the ball back down seven. Of course, they just have no chance against Miami defense. But yeah, it's like, you know, 14-0 here. They're going to kick the field goal. It's going to be 17-0. Turn off the TV, right? Then they block it. Ball goes up in the air. Mike Bass catches it. Runs like hell down the field. 14-7. Defense holds. Gets the ball right back. And then he just continued to knock the snot out of Billy Culmer and Larry Brown, and that was that.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize that undefeated season for the Dolphins, even though they dominated the statistics that Super Bowl. Yeah, it was a one score game late in the game, and Washington gets a break. They could pull it off, at least get to the tie.
Well, and here's another thing people forget: the Redskins were favored going into that game by a couple of points.
Oh, they were. I didn't realize that.
Yep. Because they had gone 11-1 and then clinched the division, so they just kind of threw it into neutral. You know, they lost down in Dallas, and then they lost the last game, I think it was the Buffalo. But they were considered, you know, the Dolphins really weren't much to look at that year. They just beat you. You know, they had a stifling defense, and they ran the ball. And Greasy threw it every now and then just to stay awake. And, you know, what a waste of a Hall of Fame wide receiver, Paul Warfield. Right? He's out there doing, I don't know, playing with his navel or something, you know, because they never threw the ball. Several games Miami had that year that they threw less than 10 passes.
Well, with the three running backs that they had, probably didn't have to throw the ball that much.
They didn't. And of course, that defense was no-name defense was nasty.
Yeah, they were pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah. That's what builds an undefeated team, undefeated championship team, I guess.
Yeah,
that's for sure. All right. So the Redskins, you know, they have George Allen. They're a veteran team because Allen doesn't really like the rooks, and they, you know, have a tight game, but, you know, Just miss out on winning a Super Bowl, their first Super Bowl appearance. What's the team do the next season?
The next three seasons, they won the wild card.
Okay.
And they never won the division again. And they never won another playoff game again because they were always playing the wild card game on the road. There were four playoff games in each conference at that time, so the wild card team never got a home game. And they got beat by the Vikings pretty good a couple of times. Getting who else beat them. But, you know, Dallas was near the height of their powers. The Redskins had the advantage over them in 72, but the Cowboys were just a little more consistent over time. And actually, in that stretch, the St. Louis Cardinals had a bit of a run, and they won the division one year. They were, you know, they and the Redskins had some great games. Jim Hart, Mel Gray, Terry Metcalf, they had very explosive Don Coryell's teams, the birth of Air Coryell before he got to San Diego. So that was a really tough division. The Giants and Eagles weren't much. But those three teams really knocked heads pretty hard. And in 75 was the first year that the Redskins missed the playoffs and went 8-6. They got back in the next year. They missed it in 77. And everybody Williams was done. But then he said, okay, you know, George, this is as good as we're going to get. And now all of a sudden, 9-5, 10-4 wasn't quite good enough. The bar had been raised drastically where he was a hero the year that they went 9-4-1 and got in the wild card in 71. They didn't quite have a parade, but, you know, it was just the excitement, all, you know, the crowds at the airport and all that. And now it was in 77, they finished 9-5. And the year before, they finished 10-4. And it was like, well, you know, we're kind of in a rut. We need to make a coaching change. So that's one thing that George did during the 7 years is he raised the bar drastically, and the bar stayed up there for a good while. So I don't want to say totally changed the culture, because George Allen built a very unique, non-replicable culture of guys that were really old, but still had enough in the tank, and George used them, knew how to use them, at least on defense. He didn't really pull much of offense. He's offensive coordinator most of that time, Ted Marchibroda, who later had great success with the Colts, rebuilding the Colts in the mid-70s. He was just a very conservative, let's run the ball, and you can imagine George Allen and Sonny Jurgensen really never quite hit it off. But one of the great stories about those Redskins is that Sonny and Billy Kilmer became the best of friends and still are. I saw a picture of them recently. I think it was a game this year. Billy came up to town, and they hung out, and they were at a Nationals game having a beer.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing when you have two guys that are vying for the same position and a gigantic payday. I mean, it's not as big back then, but it was still substantial back then to be the starting quarterback over being the backup. And you hear that a lot, where they become such close friends and lifelong friends. And that's kind of a great thing about football.
Well, I think one of the ways they say it now is game knows game. And the two of them got a very strong mutual respect for each other. You know, they liked hanging out. They said they really enjoyed the new Redskins weight room. It was a nice, the weight benches were a nice place for them to sit quietly and have lunch. and then when Theismann showed up in 74, I think it was, as a very brash rookie after he played some time in Canada, the two of them had the common cause of one of them staying healthy enough to play, so Theismann never got to play. And neither one of them thought a whole lot of him early on. I know Sonny made amends with him later on, and they got to be, I don't know if they got to be real friends, but they definitely were cordial, as Sonny was calling the broadcast every week. That's one of my favorite stories. And they were marketing, actually, the competition between the two of them. I'll never forget, I think this was 72, they were selling bumper stickers, and I had one of the bumper stickers. I'm a Skins fan, and I like Billy. I'm a Skins fan, and I like Sonny. Which means one of the worst things you could. I was always a Sonny Jurgensen fan. He was my favorite Redskin of all time. I just loved Sonny Jurgensen. I don't think he was as good as Unitas, but he was a great, great quarterback. But that him and Kilmer were able to plow through that and just turn out the noise and focus on playing football and supporting each other and encouraging each other, even when Sonny was so frustrated with injuries. In 72, he got the starting quarterback job back. He played a couple of great games, led a great win against Dallas, and then he tore his Achilles. And that famous picture of him walking off the field and Billy walking on, looking at his foot like, what's wrong? And probably wanted to give him a hug, but he had to get in. Somebody had a quarterback, so he had to get in and call the next play. That's one of my favorite stories. And that's the kind of guys that George got. Give him credit for that. He got team-oriented guys that you like being around. All of them were out in the community. I was becoming a teenager and would go to all the events. I remember sitting with Dancing Bear, Rob McDowell. He was doing a thing at a tire dealership. And he was just sitting and shooting a bull for an hour and telling a story. He was great. I met Ken Houston, signed an autograph, said something nice to him. And he looked up and he was like, gee, thanks. Like, it really meant something that this dumb kid said it, gave him a compliment. That's these guys. I love that team. I love the Over the Hill gang. They were, I think, very lovable. They weren't quite championship talent. Oh, I wish they had been. Because I would have loved to have seen that most of those guys never won a championship. Because this is their last shot, especially the ones that came to the Rams. They never won one back in those days. Would love to have seen them get one. But, boy, they were just so much fun to root for. In my formative years of, picking a team, and, it was the local team. I always gravitate to the local team. But, boy, they were just so much fun to root for.
You know, that's interesting that you say that, because I've heard so many people say that about, the other team that you supported as a kid, the Baltimore Colts of the 60s, that same way, that they were out in the community, the fans loved them, they loved each other. We've had Upton Bell on, who was the player personnel at the time during the 60s with those great runs, Super Bowl III, Super Bowl V. And he just adored those Colts teams. And so, being from the Beltway, writing about the Beltway teams, who as a teenager, your really impressionable years where you're really getting into watching these pro players, what happened when the Baltimore Colts of that era were playing the Washington Redskins in your household?
My household at that time was a Redskin household.
Was it? Okay.
And I remember one of the greatest games I ever went to see was a Monday night game in 1978 in Baltimore when the Redskins were playing. And it was probably Burk Jones' last great moment as a Colt quarterback. 78 was the year Burk got hurt. And he tried a couple of times to come in and play and wasn't able to get very far. And he kept going in and out. And he was holding his shoulder limp a couple of times. And he'd get in and throw a touchdown pass. And the Colts wound up winning that game late, 21-17. It turned out it was the last game Billy Kilmer ever started, and he was awful. Just terrible. I think he was like 2 for 11, just couldn't hit nothing. And Theismann came in and almost pulled the game out. And I was sitting next to a Theismann fan. I really took me a long time to warm up to him, and that hadn't happened yet. Then I had my best friend who was a diehard Colts fan on the other side. I'm like, I've got nowhere to go. But it was a great game. I always respected the Colts. Even before, even while I was a Redskin fan, and, Washington, Baltimore, some people try to lump them in as one area. Don't. The two areas really, in most ways, have very little interest in anything to do with each other. Baltimore folks think Washington looks down their nose at them. There's some truth to that. And Washington people think, good enough, which is why they look down the nose at them. But I've always been drawn to Baltimore because Baltimore, and I'm not finding fault with Washington, but Baltimore always had that greater sense of community. Washington, at least, back in the day, Washington was a very much more of a transient area. In fact, I remember going back to Sports Illustrated again, an article sometime in the 70s, calling something about the problem of being the home team in nobody's hometown, talking about Washington sports.
Okay.
Whereas, Baltimore, you grew up, you're an Orioles fan, you're a Colts fan, and if you're not here, keep your mouth shut. Whereas in D.C., sure, D.C. was not a sports town back in the day, it was a Redskin town. Even when the Bullets moved over to, and they had the Capitol Center, they got lukewarm support for a lot of years, even after they won the championship. And then the Capitals were kind of the same way. It took many, many years for them, but the Redskins were, and I hate saying that in the past tense, but were the passion of that town. It was incredible. And even when they were terrible, they were supported at a reasonable level. But, as I said, it took them the mid-60s before they started getting 55,000 a week. So they're just two such completely different areas.
What's the distance between the two cities?
I think from downtown to downtown is about 35 miles.
Okay.
And there's a Baltimore-Washington Parkway that connects them. So you can get there in a reasonable amount of time. It's like a federal National Park Service road or something like that. And there's, a lot of back and forth between the cities. But when it gets down to the sports teams, currently Baltimore is gravitating a little bit toward the Capitals and hockey because they don't have hockey. But one of the things when after the Colts left, and it was never public, but a lot of suspicion that Jack Kent Cooke, who had taken charge of the Redskins, was fighting against Baltimore getting a team back because he was thinking, I'll just get the Baltimore market. Okay. And that was never going to happen. In fact, my best friend, a Colts fan, never became a Redskin fan. Never was interested. As big a Redskin fan as I was, I'm like, come on. You know, 82 Super Bowl, we watched it together. He was rooting against Miami. Still have the scars from the Colts in Miami. And, I'm rooting for the Redskins with the Redskins. But he couldn't make himself root for the Redskins. So that, you know, that's pretty deeply ingrained. So Washington was never going to get that market. Now, the Orioles were able to get a lot of the Washington market after the Senators left. But Washington is never going to get the Baltimore market. It's just not going to happen. That's just the way they're wired. Baltimore's got a team, that's their team, but they're not going to take any part of Washington business. So when Jack Kent Cooke tried to build a stadium out in Laurel, Maryland, which is about halfway, thinking he was going to get the get more of the Baltimore traffic, that just went nowhere fast. And the state of Maryland did not support that. They eventually supported, because they do play in Maryland now. The FedEx Field is in Prince George's County, Maryland. So Maryland technically has two teams, but it's only just a hop, skip, and a jump from the D.C. line. So it's very much D.C. area.
I guess I never really thought about it like that. So Maryland actually has the same amount of professional NFL teams playing that Pennsylvania does.
Yes.
And you wouldn't think of that.
But Maryland only claims one.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yes.
Wow, very interesting. Okay, well, I definitely appreciate you coming on, sharing stories of growing up with the Redskins, their 1960s, 1970s era teams. And we're going to have you on again to talk maybe about the Colts or some more of the Redskins. But we appreciate your time, sir, and your knowledge and stories that you shared.
Oh, it's a lot of fun talking to you. You know, I could go on all night. So, yeah, anytime you want to do it, let's do it again. I'd love to.
Okay. And once again, maybe you could give us the website address, and we'll also have it in the show notes.
If you insist, beltwayfootballhistory.com. And still building it up. Most of what I have up there is the Baltimore writing. I'm just now getting into the actual Washington writing. But if you bookmark it, you'll see more and more stuff coming up about all three teams. Baltimore Colts, obviously Baltimore Colts. The Ravens and Redskins.
Okay. Well, we'll be sure to check that out. And thank you once again, sir. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.